From KQED Public Radio, this is the Capital Notes podcast, a special edition, I should say, of the Capital Notes podcast for Thursday, May 19th. I'm John Myers from KQED. And as I said, a special podcast because this week we're actually going to be bringing you two podcasts. You'll get our normal Friday, sometimes witty banter on the events of the week and some analysis of that. You'll get that on Friday. But this podcast on Thursday is a special one because it features the entire half-hour conversation I had this week with Meg Whitman, the Republican gubernatorial candidate, who, of course, is in the news and the election, the June 8th primary election just around the corner. I spoke to Whitman on Monday of this week, just before she had a public event in the Sacramento suburb of Roseville. It was our first real conversation. I had spoken to her briefly earlier in the campaign, but her first real sit-down conversation, half hour about all kinds of subjects, as you'll hear in a moment, a chance to talk about what she wants to do as governor and a chance to talk a little bit about the campaign. And so I thought we should bring this to you in a podcast form because we did the same thing with Steve Poizner when I sat down with him and Jerry Brown when I sat down with him back in March. And so here it is, our full half-hour conversation from this past week, from Monday, with Meg Whitman. I can't help but ask you first about some of the budget issues, given the governor put out the revised budget on Friday.
Yeah.
So when he released the revised state budget, you put out a statement that called it a shell game that pushes the problem to the future. How so?
Well, you know what? The hard work has not been done on this budget. And we've known for months, if not years, that we were going to face a $20 billion budget deficit in this upcoming fiscal year. We haven't cracked down on fraud. We haven't cracked down on waste. There's nothing been done to reform the pension program. We haven't reformed welfare. And then when you look at the budget, there's a number of different things that just kick the problem down the road, whether it's, you know, the $1.6 billion of borrowing from, you know, local governments and other things. So it isn't, truth be known, he has not taken up the real work that needs to be done to solve this budget crisis.
The plan, though, however, just, and I want to ask you about that in a moment, but the plan reduces projected spending by about $12 billion. So I'm wondering, your criticism of some of this and your opposition to new revenues, would you have cut spending even more?
I would have cut spending differently because I would have started the work years ago to, okay, how do we use systems to get out the waste and the fraud? You know, estimates are, and I'll talk about it in the town hall meeting this morning, $6 billion worth of fraud in Medicare, Medi-Cal, IHSS, workman's compensation. And then I would have taken on, you know, the areas around mismanagement. I mean, how do you end up with a $5 billion overrun on the repair of the Bay Bridge? So, you know, waste and mismanagement, you can't snap your fingers and say, okay, starting today, it's going to be better. You have to lay the pipe. You have to have the right people in the right job. You've got to take this up. So I would have cut spending, but I would have cut spending in a way that I think would have made California stronger, not weaker.
Would you have cut CalWORKs completely?
I would have reformed welfare. I would not have cut CalWORKs completely. You know, we have 12% of the population. We've got 32% of the welfare cases. So let's reform welfare as opposed to, you know, just make a broad ham-handed approach to just, you know, eliminating the whole thing.
Well, since we were talking about that, let me go right to a couple of questions about CalWORKs because you've been pretty critical of the system. Your campaign ads have talked about the very same things you talked about the number of people who are
right
on welfare. There is data, though, that shows that 78% of the state's recipients are kids.
Sure, sure. But that's true in many other states as well.
That high a percentage?
I don't know if it's that high, but every state has the same issue that we do. And so the thing is you've got to get the parents back to work. And by handing the benefit checks to the parents to take care of the kids, even when the parents are not in compliance, is not the right thing to do. So I want to do everything we can to protect the children, but the truth is we have to reform this program because it's not sustainable to have five times the welfare cases of New York when we only have two times the population. It's not okay to have you know, a five-year lifetime benefit that is not enforced versus every other state that has two. And frankly, I think it can be a solve to the budget, but frankly, I think it strengthens our communities as well. Welfare's got to be a hand up. It can't become a way of life. And I think that's why I think if we reform this program, actually it will make our communities stronger, not weaker.
Just to understand, though, given that 8 out of 10 almost of the recipients are kids, you've talked about when illegal immigration has come up. I've heard you say, I don't want the kids to pay for the sins of the parents.
Mm-hmm.
any different in welfare? It sounds like it is, in a way.
Well, these are, I mean, the people who are receiving welfare should be American citizens, right? They have been, you know, they are part of the fabric of America, and we've got to get their parents or parent back to work. And so I do have a lot of sympathy for the children, but the truth is the parents have to take accountability for getting back to work. We cannot afford what is going on here. And frankly, it just leads to, you know, a prolonged time when you don't have a job. And a job is the very best social program anyone ever invented. You get the dignity of work. You often get health insurance. You get a way to pay a mortgage or pay a rent, pay the rent. And so my view is we have got to get the parents back to work.
So let me ask you about you a little bit in this race. People often look back to a single event or a moment in their life when they made some big change, some big decision. What happened to you that made you say, I'm going to run for governor of California?
There's really a couple of things. It wasn't a lightning bolt moment. I don't think a decision of this magnitude is ever you wake up on Monday and say, I think I'm going to run for governor. So I had, I'd been thinking about it for some time. And first is, what I saw at eBay was the power of small business. I saw firsthand how difficult we make it in California for small business sellers. We had sellers in all 50 states. I can tell you firsthand, this is the most difficult state for small businesses: taxation, bureaucracy, regulation. And I was seeing that every day during my 10 years at eBay. I also had a chance to work on Mitt Romney's campaign and then John McCain's campaign. And no matter what you think about them, they are great Americans and great patriots, and they were running for the right reason. And they inspired me to think beyond my career at eBay to doing something in public service. And then I watched as California started to unravel. High unemployment rates, an infrastructure built for a population half our size, the ever-decreasing ranking on our public school system now near the bottom, and then this budget deficit. And I said, you know what? I can make a difference here, and I just refuse to sit by and watch California fail. So that's why I decided to do it.
So a little more than a year and a half ago, I spoke to you at the Republican National Convention.
Yeah.
I think I went to you while you were eating pancakes with Washington State's delegation. But I think you were thinking about the race then, at least, and you were trying to be there as a surrogate for Senator McCain, so clearly that wasn't the top of the discussion. But you told me at one point, I went back and listened to it, you told me that you said you were a fiscal conservative, and then I think your direct quote, quote, on social issues, more moderate in many ways. We've heard a lot in the campaign about how you define fiscal conservatism, but I haven't heard socially moderate. What does that mean to you?
You know, I think it's harder to categorize someone, you know, as a moderate or conservative on these issues. And so what I do is I take them issue by issue. And I think you know my positions on virtually all of the issues. I am pro-choice, but not at any cost. Obviously, I'm not for late-term abortion, for partial birth abortion. I voted for the parental notification bill. I am for civil unions, but against gay marriage. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that, you know, I don't know how you want to characterize that.
But you define that as socially moderate.
I would say yes, I would.
Any other social issues that you think would put you in that category that voters would need to understand?
I don't know whether you would call this moderate or not. I would say probably conservative. I'm a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. I don't know that's a social issue per se. I think we have enough gun laws on the books in California. We don't need more.
A little bit about the business history and your campaign, which is kind of focused on your background that way. When you hired the person to succeed you as CEO of eBay, when that person was hired, John Donahue. The belief was that he was chosen for his solid experience, his deep knowledge, his track record. I'm curious, given that you believe that was such an important thing to have all of that experience, I think the fundamental question, one way is, why wouldn't experience in public policy and government have, why would they have no relevance when people hire the next CEO of the state?
Yeah. Well, if the politicians had done such a great job, maybe I wouldn't need to run. But the state is a mess, and it has been run by professional politicians for a long time. And look at the legislature. They have a 9% approval rating by the people of California. I mean, we are down to blood relatives and paid staffers at this juncture. So my view is what we need is someone who actually knows how to balance a budget, who's made the tough trade-offs, who isn't afraid to stand up and be counted, who doesn't owe anyone anything. And, you know, you've heard me talk about the appointments process, where the top 300 are absolutely essential in your appointments, agency heads, department heads, cabinet secretaries. Often those are used as political payback. They won't be in my administration because I don't owe anyone anything. So frankly, a business perspective, having been on the receiving end of burdensome regulation, deeply understanding the economy, because if we don't fix jobs and spending, there is no way out of this mess. So I actually think my background is perfectly suited.
Well, you talk about professional politicians. Just a quick follow-up on that. Arnold Schwarzenegger wasn't a professional politician. And so I think there are going to be some voters who say, we did this before, we tried this.
Yeah. Well, Governor Schwarzenegger, I have a lot of respect for Governor Schwarzenegger. He stood up and was counted. But the fact is, he was an actor and he was an investor. He had never run a large organization. He'd never rooted out waste and fraud. He'd never utilized technology to do more with less. He had never led large organizations and brought people together to solve problems. That's experience that I have 30 years in the private sector.
Let me ask you about one of the jobs you had in the private sector, because I've gone back and looked at it and read some of the things out of your book. One that's not talked a lot about, probably because the eBay one is most recognizable to everyone. You ran FTD.
I did.
And I read in your book that after you took the job, you told the chair of the board, I think the quote is, this company's not fixable, at least not by me. And I bring it up because there are a lot of Californians who wonder if this state is fixable. And I wonder if there are any parallels at all between fixing a state that seems in crisis and a company that was in crisis. I mean, I know it had debt, there was low morale, maybe it wasn't keeping up with the times. Do you see any parallels there? Because that was not fixable, I guess, is what your sense was. It wasn't something you thought you could do.
Yeah. The situation's entirely different than the state of California, as you might imagine. I mean, the financial projections that had been put on that company by the equity partners was not realistic. California is absolutely fixable. But my view is it's going to take a very different approach and a different leadership style. And you've heard me say before that I think Einstein had it right. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and hoping for different results. And the truth is we have to run this differently because we have a government we can no longer afford. And the truth is we're going to have to go after things that no one has been willing to go after. Why has no one been willing to go after the waste in the system, the fraud in this system?
And you think there's a lot of waste and fraud in the system.
It's not just me. It's, third-party, Caltax. Other third-party folks have estimated what the fraud is. It's definitely there.
Well, but there is a little bit of debate with all due respect on that, because Caltax, I know a lot of the stuff they've done is they've done newspaper clippings. I don't know that they've done a fundamental analysis of it. And the Governor Schwarzenegger said when he came in, I'm going to root out waste, fraud, and abuse. I'm going to do an audit. Largely came back saying there's not as much there as I thought.
So you would take issue with that. That's not true, actually. I don't think he said that. But look at the California Performance Review. And this was done by 240 civil servants. This was done by people inside the system. It wasn't outside groups. This was 240 highly talented civil servants who for a year said, how can we run this more efficiently? They identified $32 billion worth of savings. We got virtually none of it because we lost political will and there wasn't management and leadership to go after it. So if we'd only gotten half of that, how great would that be? At least we'd be $15 billion on the way toward solving a $20 billion budget crisis. And so I think, I don't know anyone who doesn't actually in their heart of hearts believe that there is a better way to run this government. And the people of California expect it. We are using their taxpayer dollars. It's not government's money. It's the people's money. And I think the people have the right to expect that we're going to run this efficiently and effectively. And if you're a fraudster, you're not going to be allowed to get away with it.
I want to ask you about some more issues in the race for governor in a moment, but I want to pivot for a second because our actual issues about being governor. But I want to pivot for a moment and talk a little bit about the race and things that have come up in the race.
Sure.
Make sure that we understand your perspective on it.
Yeah.
And one of them, as you know, that's been talked a lot about is about Goldman Sachs. Mm-hmm. It's kind of become the two-word message of at least of your opponent in some ways and of the Democrats in some ways. They want to talk about your investments there. They want to talk about the investigation by the Congressional Subcommittee that you might have profited personally from Goldman and had business for eBay at the same time. I wonder if you understand, just big picture, if you understand why the questions keep coming up, why some would see this as something voters need to consider in choosing you.
Well, I'd say a couple things. I think Steve Poizner and Jerry Brand and the unions have a vested interest in bringing this up because they know I am the one who has the best chance of fundamentally taking back Sacramento from the career politicians. I will stand up to the unions. I will take on the entrenched bureaucracy. So I think there's obviously a political motive here. And with regard to Goldman Sachs, I think I've been very clear on this, right? I was on the board for 15 months over 8 years ago. This was way before any of the current controversy erupted. With regard to the IPO shares, myself, like many other people across the country who had private brokerage accounts with Goldman Sachs, got those shares. I did not see any conflict of interest at the time. Neither did anyone else. When the dot-com bubble burst, there was a question. I said, you know, I understand how they can see potentially there was a conflict. I will tell you, there was no conflict.
And I understand that. And you said you did nothing wrong. You said it in the debate recently,
too.
My question with that, though, is why didn't you fight it then? Why would you settle the lawsuits and do all that? I mean, you know, you're fighting for your reputation at that point.
Yeah, because you know what? I had a company to run. And it was a distraction. And I said, you know what? Made $1.8 million on these trades. We'll give half back to eBay, half to a charity. Let's move on. It's a distraction. I understand, you know, the sort of backward-looking criticism of it. Let's settle it and move on.
Do you think the questions get prolonged at all by the fact that people who work for Goldman Sachs now are giving your campaign money? I mean, does that prolong this conversation that maybe is a distraction?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I have raised more money than any other Republican candidate in the country, more money than any other Republican candidate in the state. And if you look at the percentage of total amount that I have spent and I have raised, it far outstrips anyone else. So I'm really proud of the fact that people have wanted to invest in this campaign. They want to invest in a vision of a new California. They want to invest in a state where we can create jobs and cut government spending and fix our education system. So, you know, I'm delighted to have anyone invest in the campaign.
So let's talk about those issues. You just talked about education.
Yeah.
I want to ask you a question about your education plan. I read through it. It seems like to me, if I was summarizing what you want to do, it seems like the summary would be, remove the rules about how the money is spent, let the local school boards have control and divvy up the cash. Is that fair?
Well, the first thing is we got to get more money into the classroom. So of the $70 billion that we spend on public education, only 60% goes to the classroom, 40% goes to administration and overhead. Can you imagine running a business where 40% of your costs went to administration and overhead?
Well, let me interrupt you for a moment, because the California School Business Association says the 40% is guidance, counseling, health services, transportation, libraries, that it's not all administration. You take issue with that?
I do. I mean, you know, we can have a debate about this. The truth is we are not getting enough money into the classroom. No question about it. This is where the teachers are. This is where the kids are. This is where the ESL kids are. This is where the gifted children are. This is where the average kids are. This is where the learning disabled kids. You talk to any teacher, and I've talked to a lot of teachers, they will tell you they need more resources in the classroom given the diversity of kids that they are now required to teach, expected to teach. So we've got to get more money into the classroom. We have got to give local school districts more control. We have to stop micromanaging this from Sacramento. I mean, you know, there's a little bit of an exaggeration, but we can't continue to tell school districts how to buy blackboards. Then we've got to increase the number of charter schools dramatically. Do you know why charter schools do better? Because the teachers and the principals have more autonomy and less paperwork and overhead to do the job in the classrooms. And then lastly, we got to pay the better teachers more. No question about it. I'm, you know, a free market theorist, and we are going to have to find the better teachers. We're going to have to pay them more, because all the research shows small class sizes, big class sizes, great facilities, not such great facilities. If you've got a terrific teacher in the classroom, the kids do great.
You've said that you think we spend enough on education. Mm-hmm. We just don't spend it in the right places. The schools, of course, have taken several billion dollars in spending reductions over the last few years. And that doesn't trouble you or worry you. I mean, you think we spend enough?
I do think we spend enough. I mean, we spend $70 billion. We're about in the middle of the pack in terms of all 50 states on spending per pupil. But if you look at how the money gets into the classroom, that's where we're, you know, just woefully inadequate. We've got two bureaucratic structures competing in Sacramento, the Superintendent of Education and the Department of Education, and all the attendant bureaucracy. If you talk to principals, and I've talked to principals a lot, and as I said to teachers, they tell you the paperwork, the bureaucracy, the categoricals. If they were given the money in the classroom to do the job, their view is that they would be able to turn this around. And the truth is, we got to do something different, because we cannot hide behind the results anymore. It is not okay to be rated near the very bottom of all 50 states.
State workers, I want to talk a little bit about that. You've talked a lot about reducing that workforce. There's been a lot of discussion. You want to talk about a 40,000 reduction, mm-hmm. as I've heard you say, the number that we've grown in the last 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
Your campaign brochure talks about you cut them over 4 years. You could save $3 billion a year by doing so.
Mm-hmm.
$3 billion?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. it's the, you know, the expenses of the civil service in this state is enormous. So if you take 40,000 individuals, shrink back down to where we were just 5 years ago, you can save about $3 billion a year. It also helps the other huge problem that California has, which is the unfunded public employee service pension problem. We've got anywhere between a $60 to $100 billion unfunded pension and health care liability. The only way we're going to get our arms around that is shrink the workforce in addition to increasing retirement age, extending vesting period, and bringing new employees in under a different plan, a 401k plan.
Well, I'll come back to pensions in a moment, but trying to understand these new employees, because that's been a source of discussion. There's data from the state that says 75% of them, almost 75%, either work for prisons or UC or CSU. So would you cut prison jobs and higher ed jobs? You would have to.
You'd got to go back to where you were just 5 years ago.
And most of them came in those areas, so you'd have to...
Many of them did, but the bureaucracy and every agency head, every department head, if you go through line by line, department by department, virtually every department has added people.
But do you... And I'm sorry to interrupt you,
yeah.
But do you sense the numbers are wrong when people say, if you look on a per capita basis, we have one of the lowest numbers of state workers per capita, right down with Florida? I mean, one of the bottom two or three?
I have read that, but, you know, big states should be able to actually leverage scale, that we should actually have a lower number of employees per dollar of revenue or per person, because we should be able to leverage scale. There's a fixed cost to providing services. So if you're Rhode Island in California, there is a fixed cost, and then you ought to be able to scale given how big we are. So, and the truth is, I don't think California fell into the ocean in 2004, 2005. In fact, I would argue California was stronger 5 years ago than it is today, and we made do with 40,000 fewer people.
If, in fact, a significant number of the new employees in that period that you're referring to work in higher ed, you'd have to get rid of them?
You'd have to ask the UC system and the CSU system, how are we going to do more with less? We have a government we can no longer afford. Is there a way to streamline services? Is there shared services? Should each of the UC system have a campus area of expertise as opposed to duplication among the different areas? You know, I spent quite a bit of time with Mark Udoff, and he believes that there is, you know, certainly he has, he thought the first 10% cuts actually made the UC system stronger and better, and that there's ways to restructure how we deliver education in a way that can be more cost effective. But the truth is, and it's amazing how people resist this, the truth is we have a government we can no longer afford. So it's not okay to say that's off the table, that's off the table, that's off the table. We have to look at everything and run this smarter and more efficiently. But I'll come back to the fraud and the mismanagement. I mean, there's $10 to $15 billion of fraud and mismanagement in the system, according to not just me,
but others. The overall state system.
Absolutely. So, gosh, wouldn't it be great to go after low-hanging fruit, the thing that would make this state stronger, not weaker, before we're starting to cut into the UC system?
And it's interesting you use that short phrase of that phrase.
Yeah, I heard Schwarzenegger said that when he announced on Friday.
Because the governor says there is no low-hanging fruit. He says we're shaking the tree at this point.
And I respectfully disagree.
Pensions, really quickly. The average retired state worker, I've read, according to the state data, gets $2,100 a month. It's an average pension of about $25,000. Doesn't sound extravagant.
Well, if you look at the pension liability, as I said, we've got between a $60 and $100 billion pension and health care liability. And the truth is that means we can't afford to pay the pensions that has been agreed to. And you know that Jerry Brown gave away the right to collective bargaining to public service employee unions when he was governor, and Gray Davis gave away the store. And the truth is, you can't we can't afford public safety retiring at 50, civil servants retiring at 55, with virtually 80 to 90% of their salary and health care benefits till the day they die.
Well, your stance on this, I think, as I understand it, is that you would have those civil servants, rank and file civil servants, you would change a lot of the structure of their pensions. You wouldn't change as much for public safety workers. Is that right? There would be somewhat of an exemption?
The only difference would be for public safety workers, I would let new public safety workers be on a defined benefit program. New rank and file civil servants would need to be on a defined contribution program. But public safety, retirement age has to go up, vesting periods have to be longer, and employee contributions towards their retirement have to go up.
Would you fight as well against this notion of spiking, where they get to
Absolutely.
Add more into that final year of salary?
Absolutely. Spiking is not what the taxpayers of California bargained for. You know, if you're a public safety worker and you've made, $80,000 a year, and you run your overtime to $100,000 a year in your final year, it's not playing by the the rules. It's not fair. It's disingenuous. The other thing that I think is dead wrong is if you retire from a civil service job and then you come back to consult to that department and still collect your retirement benefits, still collect your health care benefits, and actually get almost as much money as when you were an employee. I don't think that's what the people of California bargained for. It's wrong. I think it offends people's sensibility of what's fair. Because remember, who's paying the salary of all these public service employees? It's you. I mean, it's everyone listening to your radio show.
A couple of more questions. I don't want to spend a lot of time on illegal immigration because I think it has been discussed a lot. However, there is this buzzword that everyone focuses on as this horrible thing, and that's amnesty. Mm-hmm. I've heard you say you're against it, and I know Mr. Poizner has been battling that with you. What is amnesty to you? How do you define it?
Amnesty is when you don't face any consequences at all for having broken the law. When when you're allowing people who've broken the law to come into this country in a way that you wouldn't extend to someone else who has waited in line.
And so, with that in mind, there are proposals in Washington to do something. There's the Chuck Schumer, Lindsey Graham proposal that says, pay a fine, learn English, get at the back of the line. Do you support that?
So you know what? Until we can convince the American people that we can secure the border, that we can get our arms around this illegal immigration problem, I don't think the American people are willing to talk about any of those proposals.
So you don't support it?
The truth is we have got to secure the border of the United States of America. I spent a day on the border between Mexico and California in what they call the San Diego section. We have not given the Border Patrol agents the resources they need. They need more people. They need more motion detectors and infrared. And frankly, we need two good fences. The very first fence that was built in the 80s is 1971 Vietnam-era fencing that comes up to about, you know, midway between my waist and my head. I mean, it's just remarkable. So, and then I do think, actually, holding employers accountable for hiring documented workers is absolutely essential because people come for the jobs. And you've seen it in the recession when jobs in construction and hospitality decreased. You've seen a lot of illegal immigrants go home because there isn't the jobs here.
And do you think those are jobs that Californians, Americans, will take?
Absolutely. In a 12.6% unemployment rate, 2.3 million Californians unemployed, restaurants, resorts, hospitality, absolutely. Construction, sure.
Let me ask you a politics question really quickly. Your campaign is touting a new endorsement from Dick Cheney, former vice president. He's a bit of a polarizing force for some people in politics, I think especially in California from the polling I've seen. What do you like about Mr. Cheney?
He was the Republican vice president for 8 years. He has been a long-term, strong, conservative voice in the party and has a long track record in politics. And I think a strong conservative voice who did a lot of good things for this country.
So you're not concerned at all about some of these criticisms of him and the notion of him being a polarizing figure?
I'm not. I want everyone to be a part of this campaign from all parts of the Republican Party. And no, I'm proud to have his support.
Last question, again, is just about business and government.
Yep.
You want to run government a little bit more like a business. That sounds like a bit of a qualification, knowing you can't run it exactly like a business. I just want to talk a little bit about that quickly because, you know, businesses obviously have flexibilities that government doesn't have. A business can downsize in a way that government can't. When a business downsizes, it doesn't mean that schools close or kids stop getting money or you know, these are life and death choices, obviously, in government sometimes that are not the same in business. I'm guessing you recognize that and how you try to balance that off. I mean, because the campaign rhetoric of run it like a business starts to make some people who know government go, she doesn't get it.
Yeah. So I disagree with that.
Part do you disagree with,
sir? Well, I think you can run the government a lot more like a business. And if you do that, that will allow you to protect the programs that really do serve the people who need it the most. So if we were able to eliminate the fraud, which I think we can, if we were able to refine and reform the pension program, if we were able to decrease the number of workers who worked for the state government and reform our welfare program, we would be able to preserve some of the programs for the people that need it the most. So I think it's interesting when people say, well, you can't run it like a business because these are life and death decisions. Precisely. Let's run the part of the government that isn't life and death decisions so we can take care of the people who absolutely need it the most. And I think that is the way we're going to have to go forward here. And you look at the $20 billion budget hole that we're facing, the reason we are is because we have not done the hard work to run much of the state more like a business. Think about things like a printing plant. Why in the world does the state of California own a printing plant? why should we print anything anymore? And if we do, shouldn't we bid that out to competitive printing plants in the Sacramento area to get a better price? Why is every single employee, whether it's a bus driver or a cafeteria worker or a janitor, why are all those individuals work for the state? Why do we not empower private firms to provide those services?
And so, you firmly believe that if you went through bit by bit like that, you can get up with that multi-billion dollar number that you're talking about, that you're promising that we can save?
Absolutely. I am 100% convinced of this, because we haven't had the legislature, we haven't had a governor who knows how to do this. This is what I've done for 30 years in business. This is how you thrive and prosper running businesses, is you do more with less. You figure out, what did we do last year? Is that still necessary to do? And how do we do it more efficiently? We haven't used technology. You know, I come from Silicon Valley, 130 miles away from Sacramento. It might as well be a million miles away based on how we use technology to do more with less, how we automate functions, about how we find fraud in large-scale systems.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks very much. Nice to see you.
And again, that was my sit-down one-on-one conversation with Meg Whitman, Republican candidate for governor, recorded earlier this week on Monday before she did an event, a town hall event, in the Sacramento suburb of Roseville, and a special edition of the Capitol Notes podcast. You'll get another one this week, our normal take on the week's news that's coming up on Friday. But we wanted to get both of them out to you, especially the folks who listen on iTunes, because these come to you differently than those who click play and listen on the Capitol Notes blog. So we'll be back with the next one tomorrow. From KQED, I'm John Myers. Thanks for listening.